Today on the 21st show, the writer Will Leach was born, raised, and educated in Central Illinois. Lately, he's been writing novels, but he first made it big for creating the sports website Deadspin. His success was a long time coming, but he says he never seriously considered another path.
And I think if you have that Jones, if you have that, whether it's just the byline or like doing a great investigative piece or writing a great short story or you know, building a cabinet, like whatever the thing is, if you have that Jones, it feels like being derelict to yourself to not follow it, even when sometimes market forces might scare you into thinking otherwise.
I'm Brian Mackey with Will Leach for The Hour, today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And my guest today is a writer who was born, raised, and educated here in Central Illinois before making it big in the world of sports journalism in New York City. Will Leach is from Charleston and attended the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where he spent a lot of his time reporting, writing, and editing at the Daily Illini. To this day, he is one of the most prominent fans of Illinois sports. But Leach is best known as the creator of Deadspin, the irreverent sports site that, as we'll hear, made a name for itself by writing about sports the way everyday people talk about sports. Today, Leach writes for New York Magazine and other outlets, though he lives in Athens, Georgia. He's also a novelist. How Lucky came out 2 years ago, and his new book, The Time Has Come, was just released last month. We first aired this conversation back in March, when Leach was doing a Q&A at the University of Illinois. Because of that, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Will Leach, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
So you are coming to campus. What are your must-dos, must-sees? Do you even have those when you come to visit U of I?
Yeah, I have certain touchstones I always hit. I'm not going to lie, I will try to tie my visits to some sort of Illinois sporting event, whether it's a men's or women's basketball game, a volleyball game, or a football game. But I always also make sure one of my heroes and mentors growing up is, of course, a legend in the Champaign community, which is Roger Ebert. So I always make sure to go by and see the statue. And I am definitely that person that when you are driving by there and you see them sitting in the seat and doing a selfie next to the statue in the seat, that's me. That's totally me. I'm not the only person that does that, but I consistently do it. Every time I was here, I was very fortunate when I went to the U of I to have gotten to meet Roger Ebert. He was a mentor for a lot of the Daily Illini students. He was actually kind of my hero growing up. I grew up in Mattoon, Illinois, and I remember seeing Ebert on WAND TV in Decatur and watching the syndicated Siskel and Ebert show and thinking, wait, that guy's where I'm from. How did he get there? Oh, he just wrote all the time? Okay, I'll do that. I'll do that. That'll get me out of here. So by the time I actually met Ebert, I was already fully agog in the Ebert experience. So certainly it's always an emotional thing to get by and to go see that statue when I'm back.
Yeah, and I want to ask you a little more about Ebert a little later on. He was a big hero of mine, though at a later age for me. But you were one of these people who started out always wanting to be a writer, right? You're writing as a kid, short stories. Was it the Will Street Journal? Did I read it?
The Will Street Journal. It was actually mostly sports scores and recaps of imaginary games, if memory serves correctly. But yes, I did call it the Will Street Journal. I would preview the weekend's games. And then I would, it was a very sad thing. Of course, I was on a computer. It was all written out hand. My fake newspaper design skills were rather lacking, but I was consistent in the production.
Did you charge people for the paper?
I couldn't get my parents to even look at it. So no, I was unable to get a charge. They were like, what's he doing in there? Okay, well, tell him that the lawn still needs to be mowed.
Yeah.
So but certainly I knew pretty early on. I'm very fortunate in that way. You know, I think that as I kind of get older and I spend more time talking to young people or college students, I didn't realize at the time how fortunate I was to know at an early age what I wanted to do. It allowed me to kind of keep that as a singular focus, kind of a North Star really from a very early age. I think sometimes, you know, it took me a long time to get a really catch my first real big break as a writer. And by the time I did, it was at an age where if I had given myself off ramps before, then I would have taken them. So certainly once I knew I wanted to be a writer, it's frankly the only thing I'm any good at. So I felt like I had to stick with it. But yeah, I certainly feel fortunate. I knew early on, long before I even got to the U of I, but that's all I ever really wanted to do.
Yeah. And I'm going to come back to one of those off ramps, but you're at the U of I, you're a reporter, a columnist, and an editor at the Daily Illini. Maybe to give our listeners a bit of a time post, what stood out to you as the most memorable episodes during your time at the DI?
Well, I was there the time that there was the massive tornado that hit just outside of town. It was actually one of the most exciting stories I ever got to work on because it was such a big story that we kind of mobilized the entire staff. And like whatever department you were in, I worked, I had started out in sports, but eventually became the managing editor of the paper and just kind of worked in all parts. But when the tornado hit, it was, I believe it was 95 or 96, basically like the entire staff is like, okay, you're going here. Just call into the newsroom. Will will be there. He'll take notes of what you got and he'll cobble it all together into the story. And I was able to do that. And I wrote what I thought, like, as I kind of discovered, was a really fantastic story using all of this kind of outside material and able to find the narrative and the through line. And I realized how much I loved doing that, not just kind of condensing information, but making it clear for readers, informing them, but also making sure that the story was kept their attention. And so that's one of the stories I really loved covering because it really, you get to work together with a team and it made me kind of realize, I think I'm a pretty good reporter, but I think I'm a better writer. And I think that was the thing that made me kind of learn that. So I also covered the end of the Lou Henson era. I would argue one of my favorite moments was Lon Kruger, the now College Basketball Hall of Fame coach, who then had just left Florida to come to Illinois. And he gave an interview. He was trying to get inside of the students, as any smart basketball coach does. So he gave an interview to the sports, this first editor interview to the sports editor of the Daily Illini, who was me. So I sat down with him. And as anyone knows, if you cover Illinois sports or really cover the campus community at all, particularly in 1995 or 1996, one of the first questions is, hey, so what are your thoughts on the Chief? Because, hey, the Chief comes up every once in a while. It certainly did come up in 1995-96. He's like, what do you mean? So, you know, the Chief, you know, it's a controversy. He's like, it's a controversy. What's going on? I was like, I immediately had my lead.
Whoa,
I was like, yeah. Lon Kruger has a lot to learn about being a coach at the University of Illinois. So I always remember that experience as well.
Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah. Cause obviously the Chief was a subject of protests at the time, but also had a lot of fans. And you've written about the moment when you went from being a fan to thinking the mascot had to go. You were at the DI, if I remember correctly. You're meeting with the Pan-Hellenic Council. I don't know if this related to the Triscuit column. Maybe that's the less said about that, the better.
Might have been. Yes, but that's an old school throwback.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, the Triscuit.
I did not write the Triscuit column.
To be as clear as possible. But yes, basically what happened. I was a managing editor of the newspaper, and one of our columnists had written a column about the Greek system that I was not a member of the Greek system, but a problem with the Greek system that if I had been a member of the Greek system, I think it would have been fair for me to be upset.
Fair enough.
So they kind of called us in because, I mean, listen, never minding that a large part of the, obviously a large part of our readers were in the Greek system. It's the University of Illinois, after all, a large part of our advertisers were in there. So certainly that was the sort of thing that I had to meet with them about. You know, I grew up in Mattoon, Illinois, about an hour south of Champaign, grew up watching every Illini basketball game. They used to be on WCIA back before the days of the Big Ten Network and ESPN Plus. Every game was on WCIA. They would interrupt whatever the primetime programming was to watch Illinois basketball. So I grew up thinking Illinois basketball was the biggest thing in the world. And of course, you couldn't watch an Illini basketball game without seeing the Chief dance and getting inspired by the Chief. And it was a symbol of honor and all those sort of things. So I just thought I was a kid, you know, so I was a kid, not just that kind of a tunnel vision, even in Mattoon, with my own sort of like privilege and blind spots. And so I got to Champaign and I was starting to, I'd heard some thoughts, people not liking the Chief. And so we sat the panel in the council and we had this meeting and it went fine. And then after the meeting, some guy comes up to me, he's like, hey, dude, I love your columns. I was like, oh, thank you. Thank you very much. He's like, hey, check it out. I'm the Chief, bro. I was like, wait, I'm sorry, what? He's like, I'm the Chief. Yo, bro, I'm the Chief. I was like, and this is like this blonde haired, blue eyed Aryan man. I'm like, oh, I hate the Chief now. I know that I certainly came to that late in life, but I think it's part of getting older, right? Is having those moments you realize, oh, I'm a moron that had been entirely blinkered about everything. And it wasn't really until that moment, until I met that guy, I was like, oh, this is totally not honorable at all. The Chief is not supposed to call me bro.
Yeah.
I don't think that's supposed to happen. So that kind of helped change my thinking, which, you know, I know this is a flashpoint in a lot of things, but, you know, for me, being from a small town, being from a small rural community, the University of Illinois just kind of blew my mind on a pretty regular basis. The number of things I'd never been exposed to, the number of people that I'd never had the opportunity to meet. You know, I think a college at its best, in addition to be an educational place in the classroom, is a way to open your mind to new experiences that you would not have the opportunity to have before and meet people you would not have to before. And when I think back at the U of I, that's one of the most important things I got out of it, was learning just how big the world was and how much I had to learn.
And that's why I'm bringing this up, not because of the Chief or that story. I actually worked for the marching band during the U of I, and mm-hmm. one of my jobs was to escort the Chief safely on and off the field. And so I think I actually know who you're, I can imagine who you're talking about.
And he wasn't a bad guy, by the way, right, just to be very clear. He was definitely not a bad guy.
But it's not, so it's not what, the reason I bring it up is because this idea of college expanding people's minds or making people quote unquote woke, this is a central part of the culture wars we're in today. How do you think about that as somebody who came from Mattoon, went to Urbana? Did U of I make you woke?
I think I spent 13 years in New York City, so I think that may have been what actually did it. But I think certainly college certainly helped, I would say. Listen, that's what I want, right? Like, it's very strange to see the way this discussion, I wouldn't say evolved, I would say it's devolved. The idea that, like, wait, I'm sorry, I was understanding that there would not be learning at college. There would not be an expansion of minds at college. Like, this is what college is, right? And it's very strange to me to see, you know, people sending their kids off to college and then being taken aback by the fact that they are learning there. And certainly, you know, I do think, for what it's worth, I do think that years of working online, you know, so before I started writing books and doing everything else, of course, I spent a lot of time writing blogs and working online, which I'm sure we'll get to, but it's kind of made me kind of realize the essential fallacy of the way that we talk about things, particularly when we take them from like an online origin. The fact is, I don't actually believe that a large percentage of the country is furious about people learning things and having new experiences and thinking, looking about the world in a little bit of a different way. I do believe the people that don't like that or believe there is social capital or online clout to be taken from not believing that are the loudest. And one of the things I think that's hurt the journalism industry in the last few years is the idea that a lot of ways they're using social media as their assigning editor, as opposed to letting the, actually just covering the stories the way that they are. And I think that the idea that, this has been going on forever, right? It was called political correctness in the 90s, right? Now it's woke and so on. I think it's, I think there is a small number of people and that have existed throughout of human history that don't want to learn things and don't want the world to be any different than the way they have decided they want it to be. And the idea that we have let the fact that they are particularly loud on our social media platforms dictate a lot of our discourse, I think is pretty disappointing.
How do you insulate yourself from that? I was checking out your Twitter account. It doesn't look like you do a whole lot of engagement, mostly sharing links to newsletters. Was it ever thus? I mean, you come from a very rough and tumble world of New York journalism and blogging and all that back in the day.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I kind of learned pretty early on. I remember I had a conversation with a journalist at the Washington Post, a good journalist, who I think we were talking about the St. Louis Cardinals, who are my favorite baseball team, probably because they've won 11 championships, unlike the Chicago Cubs. Hey,
this is a White Sox show. So, okay.
Well, I have no quarter with you, but we do have more than you
exactly.
do. Anyway, there was someone debate something about the St. Louis Cardinals. I got in like a discussion about it, and I started to realize that he, the smart journalist, was starting to use all of these kind of like bad faith arguments that I know, cause I'd read his work, he would never use in the newspaper. So I kind of sent him a note. I'm like, wait, I'm sorry. I thought we were having like a real discussion. Are we not debating this? He's like, oh no. Wait, did you think we were having a real debate? This is all performative, baby. And that's really what social media is, right? It's performative. I wrote a piece a long time ago saying how it's really such a shame. If you take a step back from it, the idea of what Twitter is amazing, right? In its purest sense, the idea that I can sit there with this device in my pocket and type in, I am cold, and someone in Antarctica can see it in like a half a second, or on the moon, for crying out loud, can see it in a half a second. That's magical. That's something that kind of blows your mind when you think about that. But the problem is we put a number on it rather than just say, what an incredible communications device. This what infinite number of possibilities and how connected we can all be in this world. Instead, we decided to put a number on it. We turned it into a genital measuring contest, if you will. I'll speak a certain direction because I'm on public radio.
Stick to the euphemisms. Yes.
But it turned in what could have been this great communication device into this desperate, bottomless search for clout, or to not feel so alone, or to try to beat this guy. More people like my thing than like your thing. And it really is a shame because, you know, again, coming from the early days of the internet, it was so exciting to be like, wow, that person in Indonesia likes Quentin Tarantino movies as much as I do. How exciting. I can't believe I can interact with this person. And we've turned it into yelling at strangers online about nothing. And
that's right. Because if you tweet you're cold, the person in Antarctica is going to tell you how that is a function of your privilege.
Exactly.
And if you really want to know about cold, come to Antarctica. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. We're talking with Will Leach. We first broadcast this conversation back in March. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation with the writer Will Leach. We first broadcast this back in March when he was coming to the U of I for a speaking engagement. Will is the author of a couple of novels. How Lucky came out a few years ago, and The Time Has Come just came out in May. He's also the founder of Deadspin and an alum of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He was an editor at the Daily Illini while there. Before the break, we were talking about some of his experiences there. I want to move a little forward in your career because you mentioned earlier in the conversation about this idea of off-ramps from journalism, mm-hmm. and how lucky you felt to sort of know what you wanted to do and have that as like a guiding light for you. At one point, do you ever think about the future or I guess it'd be the present where you are like the VP of communications at Ameren or something like that?
Yes, certainly there were times in my career, you talk about starting Deadspin. I was very fortunate. Deadspin launched, I caught a break with Deadspin. Basically, I spent a long time writing for no money with nobody reading, which is generally not the most successful most efficient route to success. But I was basically just trying to get better. The idea was always, I was doing a bunch of odd jobs. I answered phones at a doctor's office for several years. There was a brief stretch where I was answering phones for Telemundo. They tell you that you don't need to speak Spanish to answer phones for Telemundo, but in fact, you do. To be able to
How could you possibly think that wouldn't be a requirement?
They listen, they offered me the assignment. I said, listen, I don't speak Spanish. They like, oh, don't worry about it. We're not paying you enough to speak Spanish. So apparently they weren't investing much in their secretarial work during that time. But anyway, so I did a lot of odd jobs just to kind of like keep the lights on in my apartment in New York and try to hopefully establish a foothold. But you know, I had just turned 30 years old and I'm answering phones at a doctor's office in a city in New York City, a city my parents don't even want to visit, wondering, wow, what happened to that honor student that was so successful at the Daily Illini? There were certainly many times where I certainly had colleagues that I from college or even after college who said, yeah, forget it, and went into law school or did something else. And that's fine. I don't mean to disparage that. More power to them. I'm sure they have nicer homes than I do. But at a certain level, I think that I didn't really know how to do anything else. And B, I felt like I did kind of believe in what I was doing. And so I could have at one point, there's a story. I think the story you're referring to is the time where my father kind of reached out. My father was an electrician. He worked for Central Illinois Public Service Company, CIPS, or eventually became Ameren. And he's like, hey, so I'm sure you probably already know about this, but I saw an internal thing for a public communications person at Ameren. I was like, oh no, he's so worried about me. He's so worried about me. And so I get it. You know, when I talk to students now, I try to always kind of emphasize, like, listen, your parents, particularly with how much college costs now, like your parents are always going to be looking for the practical thing. They're always going to be worried I mean, now that I'm a parent, I realize half the worry is I'm never going to get these children out of my house. Like, I understand at a certain level, but I also try to emphasize to kids that, like, while your parents definitely don't want you to be starving or living in their house forever, what they really don't want is for you to be boring. They don't want you to be unhappy. They don't want you to do something with your life that you don't actually want to do. So certainly there were times that there were off ramps, so I could have gone on to do something else that wasn't journalism and wasn't writing and wasn't fiction or all the things that I'm working on. But I knew I would be unhappy, and I knew I would always feel as if an opportunity was missed. And so I stuck with it. I had a conversation. I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine at the age of at the time, incredibly old age of 29, and being like, what happens? What's going to happen if there's 40 years old and we're still doing this? And we're both like, yeah, we'll still be doing it. And our parents will still think we're losers, but we can't stop now. And I'm very fortunate. I have found the people that stick with it, and even in the face of sometimes all sorts of evidence to the contrary that you'll ever break through. Generally speaking, if you work hard and get better, this is a Roger Ebert lesson. You work hard, you get better, you keep trying, you keep making stuff. Generally speaking, a breakthrough is out there for you. You just kind of hang with it.
You see, you joke about the ripe old age of 29, but I think it's worth remembering when you're 18 or 19, that's literally 50% of your lifespan away from you. And that does feel really old. There's a lesson in there about persistence, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And I think that, listen, you know, I understand, particularly when you work in journalism, right? Like, you know, when I talk to journalism students, I think their parents always want to know, and they always want to know, okay, so what's the first job out of college? As if like you work at a bank and you go to that job and then work your way up the chain. And then when you're 40, you're the senior vice president of something or other. And that's not generally like that may have been how journalism worked. That's how I thought journalism worked when I was in college, because that was back in the day where you would work for a Chicago suburban newspaper and work yourself up to hopefully getting to the Sun-Times and maybe even the Trib by the time you were 40 or so. And it was all kind of,
I remember when that felt like a path.
That was the path. That was absolutely the path. And my professors often encourage that path. And that path is obviously not there now. I'm not sure that's necessarily a negative. I'm not sure a lot of people go in. If you have a calling for journalism or you have a calling for writing, that's your calling. Not having the stable, work your way up, know the office politics and get yourself up through the system. The thing you want to do is you want to make stuff, you know. And for me, my guiding principle across the board, whether it's journalism or fiction or television work that I've done, I like to make things. It always kind of blows me away that every time I write something, even the stuff that's not good, and there's probably more that's not good than I'd like to admit, it didn't exist before. And, you know, I keep going back to Ebert, but he one of my favorite Roger Ebert lines ever is when he talked about how what he learned the most at the Daily Illini. He said, what I learned most at the Daily Illini were my three favorite words in the English language: by Roger Ebert. And I've always kind of appreciated that because I kind of feel that way. Like
the vanity of the byline.
Yeah,
definitely.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's something to the notion of when someone sees it says by Will Leach, that's me, that's mine. That's something that I put out into the world that didn't exist before. I got that Jones at the Daily Illini. And I think if you have that Jones, if you have that, whether it's just the byline or like doing a great investigative piece or writing a great short story or you know, building a cabinet, like whatever the thing is, if you have that Jones, it feels like being derelict to yourself to not follow it, even when sometimes market forces might scare you into thinking otherwise.
So you spend these years in the wilderness, you're answering phones in a doctor's office, you're writing on the side, you think it's a passion project, you get an opportunity to pitch this sports website to the Gawker conglomerate empire, if you will. And you're told that, oh, the editors, he's kind of soured on sports. He doesn't want that. Okay. You can do it, but we need a bigger name with you. Oh, okay. We can't get a bigger name. You can do it. At what point does this feel successful to you? Does this endeavor feel like a success?
Pretty soon after it launched, which was, I think, the most disturbing part about it. You know, I had been writing a lot, but, you know, I was kind of I took a lot of pride actually in being kind of like niche and being kind of like, you know, like the Brooklyn Underground writer. Oh, trust me, you don't know him, but if you did, you'd love his stuff. And I was kind of like being that guy, which is a great way to, it's basically, I'm not sure I was that guy, but it made me, it was a story I could tell myself when I was not successful, that it was just because I was niche and interesting. And so I think when Deadspin launched, it got really popular really fast. And I don't think that's because of my genius. I don't think it's because I had some sort of magical thing I figured out. I really think it was more that people wanted a site that talked about sports the way that they actually talked about sports, not the way that fans talk about sports. The example I always use is when I was at the Daily Illini, I covered the football. I got the plum assignment of covering a football game. And so I went up to the press box and I just assumed everyone in the press box would be like, they're at a game for free. There's free food up there. You get to talk to athletes. You write about sports for a living. Everyone up there is going to be so happy. It's going to be like a party up there. I don't know if you've spent any time in a sports press box. That is not what sports press boxes are like. Everyone was just miserable and waiting for this game to get over. And why do I have to talk to these athletes? And I was like, okay, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life, but I'm not going to write about sports. Gee whiz, those people are miserable. And so I always thought about that experience because I still love sports. I loved writing about sports. I just didn't want to be that. And it felt to me there was a disconnect between the people that worked in sports, whether they were media or networks or coaches or executives or whatever it was, and the people that actually consume the sports, the fans, the people that pay for everything. And so it felt like the way that the people on one side were talking about sports was very different than the way that the people on the other side were talking about sports. And I thought it would be fun to bridge that gap by writing about sports the way that I think people actually enjoy talking about sports. Clearly people wanted that because it got really popular really quickly in a way that I found personally disorienting. I went from calling myself the underground Vanguard guy to suddenly getting yelled at on national television for being the vanguard of some evil generation of blogging cockroaches in a way that I eventually was like, hey, is there a magazine I can escape to somewhere? So I eventually went to go work for New York Magazine. I'm very proud of the work I did at Deadspin. I thought the work did great, but certainly the pop and I loved what I got to do there and what people built it up toward after I left until it closed in November 2019 was exciting, right? It was exciting and I'm proud of it. But, you know, it's certainly also one of the reasons I left Deadspin is after a while, I see people that were blogging back in the time that I was blogging. And I look at them now and they're all like talking, like they're all doing live streams with their betting odds and sponsored by Barstool or DraftKings. And I'm like, yeah, I'm glad I got out of this when I did. I was proud of the work there. I loved it, but it's not my goal to be, you know, the most popular writer in the world or to have the most popular sports blogger, to sell the most books or to make the most money. I just like to do things the way that I like to do them, and hopefully they find an audience. And Deadspin got so big so quickly that there were expectations put on the site that I was probably, I knew I was probably not interested in meeting. And so I was glad that it did well. And I'm, and I so much of what I have now is because of the success of Deadspin. I'm always appreciative of that, but I was happy to be, move on to something else too.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, right now you're publishing the excellent and aptly named The Will Leach Newsletter on Substack.
I stole that title from some guy. I had to kill him.
But I mean, there's a, you know, there are a number of nationally known writers who appear to be making a decent living with that. You decided not to charge. Talk about that decision.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to pay. I'm able to get paid for my writing from a lot of different places. And so certainly starting a new thing in addition to all the other places that pay me for my writing felt almost like maybe gluttonous or churlish. But more to the point, like, you know, my Substack, I started this, the Substack weekly, just as an idea, because I write for so many different places. It would be a place to find my work, all of my work, my disparate places that I write. But, you know, eventually I kind of decided I wanted to kind of try some longer form essays and try some personal essays, some political essays, just try to like capture certain moments, particularly when COVID hit. I felt like it became very much a document of the time that we were living in. And it felt weird to put expectations on it. Like, I want people to, at the very minimum, to get what they paid for. And so I don't charge anybody for anything. Hopefully what they get out of it is, I think it's a good newsletter, and I think it's hopefully it means something to people, but I certainly don't, I don't want people to pay for it because I want people to like it for what it is. This is a one thing because I'm able to succeed in other remarks with books or write for New York Magazine or everywhere else. The idea of asking them to pay for something that some weeks will just be random musings and some weeks may be something bigger. I don't want that expectations on them, and I don't want the expectations on me. I like to be able to, you know, sometimes I like to write for the sake of writing. And I think that putting a number on that, not only that, my headlines are never like headlines. They're always just the name of a baseball player I like, or the name of a Sopranos episode I appreciate, or a Wilco song. You know, I so much of the web economy seems to be based in desperate grasps at attention. And I don't want to do that. I want people to come in. I always joke that if I wish all the titles for each of my books could be, "Hey, I'm Will. I wrote this. I hope you like it." Apparently that doesn't work.
Which is basically every tweet of yours in the past.
Yeah, and like that's kind of how I feel. Like I'm not in advertising. I'm not good at it. I don't feel comfortable with it. I'd rather just make the thing, and if you find it, great. I hope you like it. But the idea of that's the other reason I have a trouble with social media. You know, I think that like so much of it is about grabbing attention, and I'd rather be more of a grassroots hit. I mean, that's an old Generation X ethos that I'm still hanging on to. But
I was going to say. It sounds very, yeah. I just talked to Chuck Klosterman on the show a week or two ago. It sounds very Gen X. You're standing, what is that expression? Standing athwart history yelling stop. You're standing athwart SEO yelling stop. Is this the future of newsonomics though? Journalism economics? Do you see these newsletters or are institutions going to weather through?
I mean, I think a lot of writers have recognized what a lot of Americans have recognized, which is that institutions and corporations do not care about you and will throw you away in half a second. So you have to look out for yourself is what I think. And I think the Substack trend is less about getting rid of editors or speaking the real truth. I get a little exhausted when I hear a lot of people with their newsletters say, "I'll tell you the story that the mainstream media won't tell you." What that usually really means is, yeah, you lost your job somewhere or someone got cut somewhere or an editor decided not to work with you anymore because you were a pain. And so you went over to Substack and branded yourself as some sort of rebel. I think that like in a lot of ways, you know, I think some people start Substacks because media companies that they came to believe in failed them. And so I don't think it's an attitudinal thing. I would like to. So I don't think it's so much institution standing. I think there's so much good work out there. And listen, I think you found a lot of people. I subscribe to a lot of Substack. So a lot I subscribe to newsletters that are non-Substack. And for me, I think that I think there is value in recognizing how much you care about a writer or a producer or a creator and wanting to pay them for what they're doing. But as a long-term business model, I don't know what a long-term business model is. I'm just hoping we can all still live on this planet in 25 years. So a long-term business model, I've been in the business, in the media business long enough to stop. When I got into the business, I thought, oh yeah, look at that. That's the Chicago Tribune building. That will stand forever. That is the most institutional of all possible institutions. And 10 years later, it was gone. So like at a certain level,
now you can get an apartment there if you're a gazillionaire.
Exactly. Yeah, so yeah. Like I have a hard time. I used to believe that these institutions, whether they're journalism or otherwise, did have some long-term plan. You get in it long enough, you start to cover them long enough and deal with them long enough, you start to realize they're just winging it like everybody else is. And so, but I think as people have less faith in them as they used to, for very good reason, they're striking out for themselves, which I think is only logical.
All right. Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guest. Will Leach is a writer who was born and raised in Central Illinois. He founded the website Deadspin. Today, he writes for New York Magazine and is also a novelist. His latest book, called The Time Has Come, just came out last month. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And now the conclusion of my conversation with the writer Will Leach. He's a native of Illinois, attended the University of Illinois, went on to found the sports website Deadspin, and is today a contributor to New York Magazine. He's also a novelist, and he co-hosts the Grierson and Leach podcast on movies. We first broadcast this conversation back in March when Leach was coming to the University of Illinois to give a talk with students. You know, sometimes in these conversations, I like to play sort of a game of underrated or overrated. I borrowed this from the economist Tyler Cowen's Conversations with Tyler podcast. So I'm going to mention a person, place, or a thing, or an idea. You tell me if it's overrated or underrated, and if you want, why. So if you're game for that.
Can I do properly rated if it's properly rated?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. You can hedge. All right. Steven Soderbergh.
I would say underrated. I think his ability to go from one genre to the other and try certain things and capture moments. I would argue his movie, The Girlfriend Experience, is actually the best movie about the financial crisis and really kind of about capitalism in general. I think he sometimes underrates himself because he kind of like puts one foot in his movies and one foot ironically out. Very Gen X thing to do, by the way. So I would say underrated Soderbergh.
Roger Ebert.
Underrated. I'm trying to think of what accolades Roger Ebert would get that would get me to feel like he was overrated. I would have to think if perhaps there's some sort of hologram was built of Ebert's face that coded all of humanity like some sort of biodome, I then might think that he was overrated. But until then, I'm going to stick with underrated or perhaps even properly.
No, I think that's correct. Underrated, because the thing is, movie reviewing is so ephemeral, right? Like the movie came out 2 months ago. Nobody's talking about it today unless it's, you know, gets nominated for an award or something like that. He would have been such a great general interest columnist if that's
what he was. Yeah. I mean, he was so good at writing everything. And, you know, one of the things we talk about the internet, one of the most wonderful things about Ebert was he embraced the web. He embraced the web in that early days as a place to write, not just about movies, but about life. You know, the late film critic James Roeke once said that I write about movies, which is to say I write about everything. And Ebert, I think, understood that vividly. So yeah, Ebert is, I would argue, a large part of the best writing that all of us like still today is inspired more by Ebert than I think some people appreciate.
Yeah. The Marvel Cinematic Universe as cinema.
Definitely right now overrated, or more, I would say oversaturated. We have reached the point. Listen, I was actually the first couple of phases, it feels like once they hit the Infinity War type of this, they stopped. They just ran out of story to tell, which I understand when you've reached the point in your story where half of the universe dies. And that's halfway through the story.
Oops, spoiler alert.
Yeah, sorry. You can't. I don't know where you go from there. I remember the early interview with Jon Favreau when they asked him if he wanted to do Iron Man 3. And he said, He said, well, no, I can't. You've got the Avengers now. How do I tell a story, a simple story about this guy, this one character, when in the last movie he's fighting aliens through the streets of Chicago? How do I just go back to telling a story of him against a bad guy? And I think that essential storytelling problem has plagued those movies ever since. In that even the Ant-Man, like the first two Ant-Man movies, are these small scale kind of charming little movies, and but by the third one it has to be like every other Marvel movie, you're fighting for the fate of the universe, like they are in every single movie. And even the wacky comedic characters look the same, look similar to they've seen in other movies. The movie looks awful, like they're even like going cheap on the special effects. I was a big booster of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I think it's going downhill pretty fast right now.
Sports gambling.
Bad. Just, I don't know if it's underrated or overrated, but bad. I have to tell you, this is, I wrote a piece about this for The Atlantic about a year ago. We have forgotten, this is a common thing that human beings do. We've forgotten our history. We've forgotten why gambling was always separated from sports in the first place. There's going to be a major gambling scandal in the next 5 to 10 years that is going to really shake the entire foundation of sports the way that the Black Sox scandal did. And I think that we live in a world now that's so desperate for whatever financial boost we can get, or whatever growth or we can get, whether it's a sports league looking for revenue, or it's a state looking to get, theoretically speaking, a state that might need to get its bond rating perhaps in a little bit a better condition. And so we've turned to things that history tells us cause us problems, and are never minding what it does on a micro basis. So the idea that what the number of, it's so easy to gamble now on your phone, the amount of addiction issues that are going to come up with this it's going to be difficult to document. So yeah, I think sports gambling is actively bad for sports and humanity. And whenever, I will do my best not to say I told you so when it all explodes, but I don't know if I'll be successful.
Yeah, we just had a conversation on the show about that a few weeks ago as well. $1 billion a month in Illinois alone apparently wagered on sports at the end of last year. Mind-blowing. Another underrated, overrated, Peter Thiel.
Oh, definitely. If you think anything other than Peter Thiel is a corrosive force to American democracy and common decency, then I don't know how to compare. You're wrong. So yeah, Peter Thiel is a bad dude, and so definitely overrated. Unless you're like, hey, he's a really terrible person, in which case I would say that he is properly rated.
You know, and for listeners who may not be as read in on the media happenings, he was, of course, responsible for the end of Gawker, of which Deadspin was a part. Do you still mourn the end of those publications?
I do, though. I have to say, Peter Thiel is, when you're racking up the list of his offenses, I think that's Gawker and all what happened with him is pretty low on the list. I'll put J.D. Vance a lot higher than that. I would say that, I think one of the things that's frustrating about the end of Gawker is it turned in, because sometimes we can get kind of lazy with how we talk about these things. It turned into Hulk Hogan owned Gawker, but that whole thing was all Peter Thiel. Like that was Peter Thiel. That was exactly everything that's wrong with media and really capitalism. There was a billionaire guy who got mad at a media company and decided that he was going to do whatever it took to get that place out of business. And the idea that that would be cheered, even if you have been made had been made fun of by Gawker before, which I have to say I had many times, if you had no love for Gawker whatsoever, the idea that you could look at that situation and think that is good for journalism or media or a healthy democracy is very disturbing. So certainly it's a shame what happened, but I think the issues that brought up were a lot bigger than Gawker or Deadspin or anything else.
Yeah, and we're seeing some of those issues again right now with Fox News and the voting lawsuit and conversations, or the voting machine lawsuit, I should say.
Or you mean specifically the anchors of the show who are literally, their job is to give truth and news to the public, actively lying?
I don't know that that's their job. I think they see their job is to make money for their shareholders, right?
Then they should say that on television, right. But they don't.
Right.
So, yeah, and now here we are.
Last one of these, underrated or overrated, Reese Witherspoon.
Oh, I would say Reese Witherspoon is either properly rated or underrated. I'm a fan of Reese Witherspoon generally, and I think an underrated Gen X icon. I think that she's a better actor. She's known as kind of a rom-com person. She's had her moments in that, but I would argue that she's given some really solid performances. And listen, I've read the book Election. It's a perfectly fine book, but Tracy Flick does not become a part of our American culture without Reese Witherspoon's interpretation of her. So very pro Reese Witherspoon.
And the reason I bring her up, and I figured you may want to say something nice about Reese Witherspoon or Jenna Bush or Oprah Winfrey, because this leads me into asking about books and the book industry. And you've written about how important they are in the modern book industry. Can you just talk about how you have found it? Because maybe we should even back up a step and just talk about your previous novel, because I understand you wrote that entirely on spec. You didn't even tell your agent you were working on it. Why not?
Well, one of the reasons was because I knew he would tell me to stop and write a sports book, because I was mostly known as being a sports person. So I figured I would just not tell him and then just let him deal with it. I would also say, though, that one thing I discovered, how lucky is a story about a man with a serious disability, something called spinal muscular atrophy, which is a disability that my son's best friend has. So it's obviously something that touched our family. He witnesses a crime and tries to report it, but has difficulty for a variety of reasons. Good elevator pitch, by the way. And I wrote that story mostly to talk about Daniel, the main character, and his view on life and spinal muscular atrophy and try to put something good into the world. But of course, it has to. Because that happens, there's certain expectations that people have if the book's going to be a thriller, if the book's going to be this or it's going to be that. And I knew, because of the prominence of books like Gone Girl, which is a very good book, by the way, but those books have been so successful that I knew all publishers would want those books to be like that. So if I worked with an editor, they would constantly guide me to hit certain they want me to hit certain benchmarks that the story is supposed to hit and hit certain level and make it give it a plot outline that everybody understands. And I kind of wanted
people told you to make it more twisty, right?
Yeah, twisty. Yes, yeah. It's probably the best way to put it. And I tend to find mercifully that my daily life is actually not very twisty, and I think most people's daily life is not very twisty. And so I just kind of wanted to write the story kind of more organically. And I felt like if I did that on my own and wrote the book the way I wanted to do it, I would be less likely to succumb to the temptations of a clear plot arc. There are things that happen in the book, and I hope it's exciting, and I hope it certainly works. But I did not want it to just feel like another Gone Girl or another whatever. And so I wrote on my own without showing it to anybody. And then I gave it to my agent. I physically printed it out and handed it to him. And he's like, "Great, thank you. You know, you could just email this to me, right? I'm glad you had your moment, though." The point is that I kind of wanted it to be organic and be its own thing. And to be fair, we pitched it to people and we went 0 for 30 publishers, because they were like, "Yeah, but why doesn't it have this plot arc?" But fortunately, we found the right editor who got it and knew what the book was supposed to be. And I would argue one of the reasons that people have responded so well to How Lucky is because it is different, because it feels different, it reads different, it has different story beats than people have gotten used to. And I think its unconventionality has, I think, really worked for it. So I understand why genre is a big thing in books, and people, it's like a supermarket. They all want to know what shelf everything goes on. They want to know, is this going on the romantic comedy shelf or the thriller shelf or the poultry shelf or the baked goods, or they all want to know where that goes. And that's fine. I understand that, but it seems very, I have to tell you, it feels kind of strange to me. I mean, a book is you can put literally anything you want to in a book. You can put whatever you want. The idea of I always joke about this, people, because I write about sports and movies. People are always saying "Oh, what's your favorite sports movie?" And I actually don't love sports movies very much. And the reason for that is what I love about movies and what I love about sports are actually somewhat similar. They can be anything. They're unpredictable. You never know what's going to happen in a good movie when you sit down and watch it. You never know what's going to happen. The same thing with a sporting event. But for some reason, for sports movies, we've decided, oh no, they have to have the arc. They have to have the sports movie arc. And I don't like to know what's going to happen. I don't like things to be conventional and have this and that sameness to it. So for me, I would rather just write the book and they can just tell me what kind of genre it is rather than kind of follow that. But the book industry is very genre specific in a way that that is confusing to me, but I'm just gonna do like I do with everything else and just kind of do it the way I want to do it, and hopefully we can cobble it into whatever square peg we need to.
Your next book is called The Time Has Come, and the time is coming for us to end our conversation, but I don't know if you can talk briefly about it. I read you compared it to the movie Shortcuts or Magnolia, sort of series of interconnected stories.
Yes, so I will be careful to not give away plot details, but at the beginning of the book, it's been made very clear that a major incident is going to happen at 5:15 on June 24th, and the character that makes that incident happen is telling you that they're going to make that incident happen. Throughout the rest of the book, interspersed with that character building up to that day, you follow six characters on their day, starting in the morning, leading up to where they end up at the place where this happens at the end of the day. So hopefully you get to really know the characters and get to care about the characters. And then they end up in this place, which is a pharmacy called Lindbergh's Pharmacy, where the dramatic event happens. And we see how these characters deal with peril and ultimately try to come together. You know, what I like to write about things. I like to write about normal people who are good. People have asked me why my characters are always nice in my books. And the fact is, I like to hang out with nice people, and you spend a lot of time with the people you write about in your books. So I tend to like to write about good, nice people who mean well, even if they're flawed. And so that's really what the book's about. I have not, to be honest, as you can probably tell, I haven't nailed down the elevator pitch for this book yet, but I promise this is why I wanted to call it. I'm Will Leach. I wrote a book. I hope you like it. I'll come up with a better when it comes out, I promise.
Nice. All right. Well, that is going to be out May 16th, 2023, available for pre-order now. Will Leach, thank you so much for being with us on the 21st Show.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I hope everyone comes out tonight. I'm looking for a fun crowd out there.
And that was my conversation from March with Will Leach. Obviously, the event is not happening tonight. It was happening back in March. And the book we just talked about, How Lucky, it came out last month. You can get it now wherever books are sold. And that's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.